It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. The man we all know as Mark Twain has been dead for more than a century, but his ideas, words, and spirit are everywhere. In fact, his work is thriving in the internet age. This hour, we'll talk about Twain's life, work, and legacy. Later in the hour, I'll talk with Will Thompson, who's an Iowa actor who portrays Mark Twain. But first, Harry Katz is the author of the new book, Mark Twain's America, a celebration in words and images. He's with me now. Hello, Harry.
Hey, hi, how are you? Thanks for having me.
Well,
I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for being here today. And with all that has been written and said about Mark Twain, and with the publication of his own autobiography finally released just 4 years ago, why? Why write another book about Mark Twain?
Yeah, well, that's the first question I had to ask myself. He was a hero of mine, and he's a legend, an icon. But I felt this was right before the autobiography came out, and a friend of mine from college who happens to live in Redding, Connecticut, where Twain died, we talked about Twain, and I found out that there are all these people who just on the internet reading that autobiography. Why is Twain so relevant and resonant today? That's what I had to get at. And I work with pictures. And I worked at the Library of Congress. So looking back at history and sort of stripping away our assumptions and our illusions to see what Twain saw, to see the people he interacted with, to see his life as it played out in pictures, I think gives you another sense of the man and maybe a fuller sense.
Well, and this book really puts his life and work into context like nothing I've ever seen before. But it's interesting to me because, of course, so much of his work evokes a time and place. So if you read Twain, you get an idea of life on the Mississippi, although he also crafted that world to be what he wanted it to be. So you're giving us a little less varnished image of the world he lived in.
Well, with Twain, even with all the scholarship, and I'm beholden to generations of scholars who have attacked his life and career. There are places in his life where we only know what he tells us, and he's such a fabulous storyteller that you don't always know what's truth and what's fiction, and that was his gift, but it also it's a challenge. And by looking at the pictures and seeing the context, seeing what was going on around him, I just think you get a better understanding of what he was responding to. He was unique in that, and Iowa plays a very important role in this. He had this plan. He had somehow settled on a plan for the things that he wanted to do, in the print shops that his brother ran and the newspapers in Iowa. He sort of developed an idea and a persona, and he followed that persona right through his life, and it has lasted and endured through generations. It's astonishing.
Well, I think a lot of people who have read Tom Sawyer think that they have this idea of Mark Twain or Samuel Clemens as a child, because we just assume that that's all autobiographical. But he grew up in very difficult circumstances, and death was really...
Well, that's where I started. Right. I always, with these books, I start off with an image, and the image that I started with was this young boy on the edge of first the prairie in Florida, Missouri, where he was born. He was sickly. He was sensitive. They moved to the river when he's turning five, and his world changes. He grows stronger physically. But he retains a lot of the sensitivity of a sickly child and a sense of apartness. And there's a spiritual part of this as well. But he hits the river, and the river brings him everything. It brings him everything he could possibly want. It's also a very rough life that he, as you say, the things he saw as a child, no child should see. But but in the end, he sort of processed those into this world that on the one hand, he goes back in Tom Sawyer and idealizes the river. On the other hand, he goes back in the 1880s, he goes back to see Hannibal. Tom Sawyer was written really from memory and imagination. He hadn't been by the river for 10 years. But in Huck Finn, he and Life in the Mississippi, where he also describes his time in Iowa. The river becomes something different because he has seen the problems in the South with their poverty and sort of backwardness and reluctance to enter the modern age. And he has seen the modern age. He's been living in Hartford and seen what the modern world was. And he couldn't reconcile that with the South, which was sort of staying in its own cocoon. And so Life on the Mississippi and Huck Finn really stripped that river and that landscape and the boyhood, and you see it as a man and with all its problems and flaws exposed, but with all its awesome beauty and spirituality and the people, the characters that went through there. And he processed all that and wrote about it and just developed this incredible worldview, which he then internationally later in his career.
You write about his family a little bit and the fact that he lost several of his siblings quite early. Life was precarious and dangerous. But you also write that his mother filled the house with a sense of fun and laughter. It sounds like his dad did not.
Well, his dad was a study in failure, unfortunately. He had grand designs. Even before they got to Missouri, he was, a prominent member of the community, but that prominence was based on expectations and speculation. It was not based on hard cash. So he took all his earnings and put them in this Tennessee land. And the Tennessee land became this boondoggle that lasted. That basically lasted for decades until the expectation that this Tennessee land would have some worth, but it didn't because of a series of recessions and depressions that really kept the land prices at a minimum. So he never realized that dream, but he still kept pursuing big speculative ventures. When they got to, they went to Missouri on speculation that it would be better. He got involved. His father got involved with the Salt River Association, which was supposed to develop this, basically a large creek into a mighty waterway, in the manner of 19th-century speculation. They were all speculating around rivers and railroads, and so, but they all failed. For John Marshall Clements. And so he was really the sort of figure that was just an aloof, preoccupied. Sam's mother kept all the kids together and really kept the house going. She was very pious, but she was also very had a lot of a sense of humor, and I think that and curiosity, which I have to say that young Sam took in.
And he also, like his father, wanted to be wealthy. He wanted to be a man of means, which of course he became in his life. But becoming a writer doesn't seem at this point in time like a surefire path to
Well,
success.
he, believe me, he hedged his bets. I mean, when he left Iowa in the middle 50s, he had this dream of actually going to South America and gathering cocaine and starting a cocaine trade. It was this bizarre idea that ended up with him in New Orleans thinking about going to Brazil, but instead being taken on as an apprentice because on the voyage down to New Orleans to do this bizarre trip, he met Horace Bixby, who then hired him as an apprentice on the river. And he became a steamboat pilot instead of a, I guess, a drug runner. There are these just bizarre episodes in his life where you see him reaching for that brass ring, and it's just completely nonsensical. But then, all the way through, he has another plan, and there's a plan B, and the plan B turns into just an amazing, remarkable career. He ends up as a pilot on the river. Then he sort of when the traffic on the river is shut down by the Civil War, he goes west with his brother Ryan into Nevada, and his motive there is to strike it rich in the gold and silver mines. And he'd be back in 3 months, and he'd be rich. And that didn't happen. He pursued life in the West as a prospector, but he kept writing and he kept commentating. He had begun in I think 1856. He gave his first public talk in Iowa, and so he in Keokuk, I believe, and then moved west, and he became a lecturer. He became a celebrity. He became a known quantity. But at the same time, he was still pushing the limits of civilized society, and getting kicked out for putting together hoaxes and creating a ruckus in his newspapers that he was writing for. And ultimately, that became the gold that he found, and not any ore found in the mining camps. The other thing is he kept speculating throughout his life. There's
Right.
a famous print.
We will talk about some of those
Yeah.
speculations in a little while. We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. My guest right now is Harry Katz. He's the author of the new book, Mark Twain's America, A Celebration in Words and Images. Coming up in just a moment, Will Thompson will also be joining the conversation. He is an Iowa actor who portrays Mark Twain, and you're welcome to join the conversation as well. What's your favorite story about Mark Twain? Do you want to do any fact-checking this hour? Is it true? 866-780-9100 is the number to call. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Mark Twain. A new book, Mark Twain's America, A Celebration in Words and Images, gives us access to some images that tell us a great deal about the life of Mark Twain that come from the Library of Congress. It also puts his life and work into context like no other work has ever done before. With me is the author, Harry Katz. And Harry, when you were thinking about writing this book, you encountered a group of people that you referred to as Twainiacs. There are a lot of people who really, really care about Mark Twain.
Well, I go back. This whole book was inspired again by a college classmate of mine. She lives with her son in Redding, Connecticut, where he died, and where there's a Twain Library, wonderful place. And she suggested a book on Twain, and she her and I started looking into it. Her son would quote Twain daily on the internet. I started looking into it, and they referred to Twainiacs, and so I discovered this whole subculture. I was a member, unbeknownst, because I keep a Twain book by my bedside to read the sketches and the articles. I have always done that. But there's this there's this layer of people who just live and die by Twain, and I was trying to figure out where that came from. And I think if you look in the context of what was happening during his lifetime, and this generation. We've come full circle 100 years later, where his work, which is so prolific and so wide ranging, in the internet age, the digital age, you can get access to all that material, and it begins to make more sense. And you can either dive deeply into the scholarship and his own writings, or you can just take his quotes from Pudd'nhead Wilson's calendar and tweet them out. It's kind of astonishing what I found in terms of the depth of love for this man.
Well, and we have someone who I think could be safely described as a Twainiac here in the studio with me today. This is Will Thompson. He is an Iowa actor who portrays Mark Twain. And Will, you've been doing this for 40 years now?
More or less, yes. Thank you.
Thank you so much for being here today. Can you tell me when you first got interested in Twain and when it went beyond, hey, I like this book?
Oh, I'd read the usual childhood books, you know, Tom Sawyer and the like. And I always loved the way he wrote and his geniality and the specific joy that he took in writing. I didn't learn until later how much work it was. And of course, like a lot of people, I'd seen Hal Holbrook do it on television in the 60s. And I just recently saw Holbrook up in Cedar Rapids, and he's now 90 years old and still doing it. He's lived a lot longer than Twain did. The first time I actually considered looking into the deeper works was when I was in college. And then I had the opportunity to stage manage a production of the Actor's Portrait series when John Chappell was replacing Al Holbrook. And he looked at me during the session of getting him settled in his dressing room and so on and said, you know, you've got the face. I don't know why you're not doing it. And it kind of stuck in my head, you know, because I really loved his short works. I really loved the short stories. And I think it was the surreal and the bizarre humor that he could generate, the way he could hide cynicism inside of laughter and vice versa.
And we were just talking a little bit before the break about how Mark Twain got into this world of giving lectures. And let's revisit that a little bit, Harry, because you mentioned Mark Twain's trip out west, which was supposed to be sort of a three-month get rich
sure.
quick scheme, right? And turned into what?
Like Gilligan's Island.
Right. Turned into what? 6 or 7 years,
yeah.
Right?
And well, yes.
And part of it was that he wanted to avoid fighting in the Civil War, right?
Yeah. I mean, you have to see what his. He was a steamboat pilot. He had reached his life's ambition. Of being a steamboat pilot, and he found unbelievable independence and freedom, but he also found sort of responsibility for guiding people safely. So when that stopped, he was in a bind because he for just a blink of an eye he joined a local militia of Hannibal men, but. And writes about that episode later. It was comic, but could have been very tragic in 1861. And then his brother, through political connections, gets the job of secretary of the new Nevada Territory. And Twain says, "This is it. I'm not going to let him go, and strike it rich without me." So he sort of takes off, and then that trip is a transformative trip because he goes out west. He sort of finds his voice. He finds the name Mark Twain that defines him. And, you know, he finds all the characters and the richness of vitality of this culture out there that's very different. And that's where he really takes off, and he becomes a public persona as well on the lecture circuit in Nevada and then in California. And takes all that back east and became Mark Twain.
And what was it that made him sought after on the lecture circuit? What kind of knowledge was he asked to share?
Well, I think that, you know, I think Will and Hal Holbrook, these folks who get into that character, I mean, that character is so different from what was around them at the time. There were other people like Artemus Ward. There were other lecturers and comic lecturers, Josh Billing, Petroleum V. Nasby, who's one of the great characters. And so there were sort of role models for him. But I think what made it different is what we'll talk about. And it's laughter wrapped in cynicism and cynicism wrapped in laughter. He used the comic mode to really get at essential truths.
And
that's what I think makes them different.
And will you slip into character just a little bit for us as Mark Twain, and give us a little bit of a taste of what it was like to be at a Mark Twain lecture.
Ladies and gentlemen, I wish to introduce to you a man whose great learning and veneration for truth are exceeded only by his high moral character and majestic presence. I refer in these vague general terms to myself. I consider introductions unnecessary, but where it is the custom, I like to handle the deed myself to make sure all the facts are straight. I was born modest, but it wore off. I was only introduced twice in my life. Once was by a miner up in Red Dog, Colorado, who stood up and said, I only know two things about this fellow. One is he's never been in the penitentiary, and the second is I don't know why. Second time it was by a lawyer, stood there with his hands in his pockets and said, I want to introduce to you a Mr. Mark Twain, a humorist who is really funny. A very rare creature indeed. Why, I was struck speechless by this complimentary thunderbolt. Never before in my life had I received a compliment so richly phrased or so well deserved. But we had a much rarer creature in our midst than a humorist who was really funny. We had a lawyer kept his hands in his own pockets.
Right, an introduction in the character of Wonderful. Mark Twain. And, Will, you know quite a lot about these lectures that, that Mark Twain gave because, of course, this is part of the performance that you mm-hmm. do. And when he started giving these talks out in California, he was reporting on trips that he'd taken to Hawaii. But, mm-hmm. I mean, really, it was also stand-up comedy.
Definitely. And the funny thing about Twain is that he wrote on several occasions about the way that Americans tell a story. In fact, there's the famous How to Tell a Story kind of short piece, an essay, where he compares Americans' sense of storytelling and humor to the European. And the European is, I'm going to tell you a very droll story. This is very humorous and you'll enjoy it. And then he starts telling the story and then he stops and says, well, here comes the good part, and tells a little bit more and then stops and says, oh, now here's the really funny part, and so on. And then an American would tell a story like he tripped over it and mm-hmm. and kind of stumble along as if he was completely unaware that anything he was saying was funny. And Twain talked a lot about how that worked. So he definitely understood himself as a stand-up comic in the way that we see them now. He sometimes did not have one or two but three punchlines at the end of a story. You know, he'd give a little pause. He'd take a little puff on his cigar, you know, look around to observe the effect of the last punchline and then throw on another one. And he was kind of heaping firewood onto this little blaze that he had going. And I think that's the thing that's so contemporary about him. We think of 19th century lectures is stuffy. Ironically, well, coincidentally, Paul Faddout published a large book called Mark Twain Speaking that was published by the University of Iowa Press that contains a lot of the written records of his public speaking engagements that word for word, you know, people would take down what was being said at public lectures and they'd be in the newspaper the next day. This was the way things were before the advent of radio and television.
Harry, as he was taking on this persona, this public persona as Mark Twain, he seemed to be very aware of what he was doing. He even refers to it at some point as branding, which seems very much ahead of his time.
Well, there were precedents for branding, although nothing on the scale that Twain. You know, Ben Franklin was probably the first national brand in for Richard's Almanac, and the way he sort of cultivated his career and his life. P.T. Barnum, But Twain did it self-consciously from a pretty young age, even in his, you know, when he's around 20, and in Iowa, he has this sense that he's going to create a life as something beyond, something different. And so he really self-consciously cultivates a sending letters prolifically, writing sketches, engaged with Orion in the print shop. He really begins to develop it, and when he gets when he gets to the West, it just takes off, and he knows what he has to do. He meets these people. He meets Artemus Ward. He meets Bret Hart. He meets all these folks who are doing what he wants to do, which is to get on stage, to perform, and to write and have his writing published.
Let's go to the phones. You can join our conversation at 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. Jim is on the line in Spencer. Hi, Jim.
Yes, hi. Just a big Twain fan and have really enjoyed hearing what you've spoken about with Mr. Twain. I think one thing that I would mention is that people might have the impression that Mark Twain spoke for the first time in Iowa publicly, but that was in California, in San Francisco, and he, which was probably, you were referring to Iowa, not necessarily his very first time. But in spite of all that, I loved the way that Mark Twain was able to utilize the name, a predecessor of his, had used the name Mark Twain, and he had belittled this man as a poor writer, which was probably true, but felt guilty in a way when he died shortly after that, and it took him a while to steal the name, but he took pleasure in it eventually, I think. And I think the thing that is really the saddest about Mr. Twain was all of the people that seemed to die around him, and people that were very dear to him. And I think that, in spite of the bankruptcy and his ability to pay everybody back, it really took a big toll on his life. And I think, he was a sad man in the end, unfortunately.
Jim, thank you so much for calling. And you covered a lot of territory there. Let's focus on the name Mark Twain, because he did go by a number of different pseudonyms before that. Does he write about how he happened on that name and why he chose to take it himself? Harry, do you know?
Yeah, sure. Mark Twain is what the riverboat crew would use to determine the fathoms under the boat. So, Mark Twain, 2 fathoms. You got plenty of space to get your steamboat through. And there are various stories. I think if you read Ron Powers' wonderful biography, Twain at various times had stories about where he got that. But it's pretty clear that in 63 he was looking quite consciously toward the river as a potential. He wrote about what he knew. He wrote about what he knew, and the river was on his mind, and his career as a pilot was on his mind, and that's where he went. There are various stories that there was a riverboat pilot but to me, this is one of those gray areas where Twain sort of embellished the truth on various occasions, but it just came out from, I think, a self-conscious journalistic exercise in defining his own persona and aligning it with the river.
Will, did you have anything you wanted to add?
Oh, I think that it's part of the character of the man that he dressed in white and had this carefully coiffed, unkempt look, smoking a cigar and walking down the street. I think it's a visual metaphor for a steamboat. I think he became that character when he went out in public. He once commented to a lady once asked me, "Mr. Twain, why is it you always wear that white suit?" I said, "Madam, it has been my experience that naked people have no great influence on society."
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. We're talking about Mark Twain this hour, his life, his work, and his legacy. The new book, Mark Twain's America, A Celebration in Words and Images, was written by my guest, Harry Katz. Also with me, Will Thompson. He's an Iowa actor who portrays Mark Twain. We'll be back in just a moment, and you are welcome to join our conversation with your questions, your comments, your stories, 866-780-9100. Tweet us at IPR Talk or send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. This is Talk of Iowa. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about Mark Twain. Harry Katz is the author of the new book, Mark Twain's America, A Celebration in Words and Images. Will Thompson is also here. He is an Iowa actor who portrays Mark Twain. And I want to talk a little bit about the extensive traveling that Mark Twain did. I mean, in his early life, he wanted to get out on the river and travel there. And then he took that journey west that lasted for more than 6 years. And later he traveled extensively in Europe and the Holy Land. Now, I think it's clear that some of this was to gather material for lectures and for writing, Harry, but was there something deeper, something that drove Samuel Clemens to travel?
Yeah, sure. I mean, on the one hand, he did insist that, you know, he wrote, you know, what he knew and he was always looking for new frontiers, new material, new characters. And I think that sort of wanderlust starts in Hannibal with the river and the people that he sees coming in and the stories that he hears from them coming off the river boats. There's a sense of that his destiny is away from Hannibal, and he goes off to see the East Coast cities, and then he comes back and he stays in Missouri and Iowa for a little while, and then he's off and running on the river and then to the west. And the 60s were filled with lectures. I it's interesting because he traveled a lot in the 60s on the lecture circuit, and he didn't enjoy it so much because of the wear and tear. But when he had a project like Innocents Abroad, where he sort of self-consciously went out on this first public tour of the Middle East on a ship, you know, the first public cruise to the Middle East where anybody who had the money for the fare could go. And he goes off, basically to take part in this pilgrimage, but in a very ironic and very irreverent way. And his letters created a sensation, which turned into the book Innocents Abroad. And travel was it completely upended all the conventions of travel fiction, and he saw this was one way where, as an observer, as an outside observer, he could comment and at the same time just create fantastically, wickedly funny books.
Well, and you mentioned travel fiction of the day, but also travel nonfiction. I mean, traveling was something that so few people got to do extensively,
exactly,
that reading about this kind of a journey was something that people loved to do. But what he wrote was nothing like what anybody had ever written before. And it was also, my impression is, far more popular than anything anybody had written about this before.
Well, he in Innocents Abroad and Roughing It in particular, he sort of defined the West in a whole new way. He defined it. And you're on that stagecoach, and the 6-pound, you know, dictionary is coming off the rack and hitting you in the head. It's a hysterical, I think it evokes all the cartoon comedy of the 50s and 60s, with the way he describes, some of his adventures. It shows us the future, but it's sort of a different view of the Wild West. It's the view of the miners and their tall tales and the hoaxes and all the things, all their illusions and all their delusions. It was just a fabulously rich place for him to do his thing.
Well, and we consider him a man who had a great deal to say about race in this country. I found it very interesting in your book, Harry, to go back and read some of his writing from the West, where he wrote about American Indians in a not sympathetic way at all. I mean, his views on race really evolved during this time, and that became something that he really really wanted to talk about and wanted to make a difference with, I sense.
Yeah, I mean, there was a real clear evolution from, again, you know, a kid, a 20-year-old kid who leaves Missouri, leaves Iowa, and goes off. And you know, he finds in the West, he finds Indians, but they're the Native Americans that are sort of outside the forts, outside these rough towns, and they're not the noble savage that he had come to, you know, think about in his mind, and that so many Americans. This was a very disappointing glimpse of another side of that character. But it evolved, you know, in the 70s, when he got involved with Livy's family, who were abolitionists. And
Olivia, you know, Langdon was his wife.
Exactly. I'm sorry. Livy Langdon. Clemens, and she was part of that sort of the New England and New York Republican liberals, and he marries into this family, and he evolves very quickly. He meets Frederick Douglass, he meets Harriet Beecher Stowe, who wrote Uncle Tom's Cabin, and eventually settles in the same neighborhood outside Hartford. He's introduced into this world of liberal views and progressive views, and he I think that triggers, you know, the other side of him. It's some of the more civilized side of him. It says we have to do better, we have to do more to create, you know, an equal world for everybody here in America and make it livable. He wants a Republican democracy with, you know, industry, but also nature and all the ideals that were developed in the 19th century for moving forward.
And he didn't have many nice things to say about Congress, did he, Will?
No.
You have a little passage that you perform that he wrote or gave in a lecture about Congress. Can you perform that for us?
When I was putting together my first book, I did a stretch in Washington as a newspaper reporter. I hated to do it, but I couldn't find honest employment. Occasionally, I was sent down to Congress, that grand old benevolent national asylum for the feeble-minded, to report on the inmates there. It was very entertaining. Never before in my life had I seen a body of men with tongues so handy or information so uncertain. Why, any one of them could talk for a week without ever getting rid of an idea. Why, if one of those men had been on hand when the deity was on the point of saying, "Let there be light," we never would have had it.
Let's go back to the phones. Charles is on the line in Des Moines. Hi, Charles. Hello.
Good morning.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Oh, I was just talking about the universality of the humor of Mark Twain.
Do you have something in particular you want to talk about?
Oh, my dad used to read me Mark Twain stories, and apparently to make me more well-read and cultured. And the humor involved was sophisticated in a way, and banal on the other. You know, I was 8 years old, and my dad's reading me The Jumping Frog of Calaveras County, and he couldn't even finish it because he was laughing so hard. And, you know, it really turned me on to literature in general. So it's an open access point, and it's universal. It has never gone away. The humor that he brought to the stage will never perish.
Charles, thank you so much for your call. And it is...
Could I respond?
Yes, please do.
Yeah, thanks. Because, you know, I think we forget when we're reading Mark Twain and reading it in isolation, he wrote for this work to be read aloud. He wrote it, as Will talked about. He
Absolutely.
Was a storyteller, and he was working in the oral tradition. The comic stories that he considered it a keenly American phenomenon because of the oral nature of it, the performance nature of it. The comic timing of it. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, that's critical that we remember that that these works were almost universally meant to, at least the family novels, the river novels, Prince and the Pauper, to be read aloud so people could add their own expression. And it was a profound and universal access point because not everybody could read. And so the other point that my book brings out is that he was a visual man. You know, from very early on, he understood the power of images. And he, in all his great early travelogues, he's the key person in those images. It's Mark Twain going through these, and you see him in these comic sketches that are autobiographical and really self-portraits, or portraits by the illustrator. So, you know, he's very much part of that.
And we talked a little bit about his white suit, but he loved costume and the power of whatever clothing he could wear. He loved to shock. I mean, Harry, you tell stories of him appearing in a seal coat.
I grew up in Boston, and, you know, I can just imagine this rube. You know, he cultivated on the East Coast the persona of a rube. In the West Coast, he was a dude. He was sort of the first dude out in the West, you know. And so in Boston, he wears this sort of sealskin coat that, you know, in a city that's very proper with tails and top coats and great coats. And then, you know, he, again, as Will mentioned, he starts wearing a white suit, and it's a conscious. He talks about it as a conscious effort, and he wears it for effect. It's part of his Southern mentality. There's a sense, I think, of kind of an avatar, but it comes out of his self, Southern background, and also just the presence that it creates when you, you know, fling off a coat and there's this resplendent white suit.
Well, and Will, you were talking about his hair earlier, mm-hmm. the crazy gray hair, but he cultivated that as well. You said that he had a barber come in once a week?
Yeah, just to give him a trim so he would look unkempt.
Yeah. And he also, he got an honorary degree from Oxford, and he loved that cap and gown,
right,
too, didn't he?
Yes, he appeared at his daughter's wedding wearing his Oxford robes, and it used to double as a bathrobe in his house. He would walk around in it, you know, like a house coat. And he was a character, but at the same time, I think one of the things that's worth observing, one of my favorite essays is an essay about writing that's called Fenimore Cooper's Literary Offenses.
Yep.
And it's 11 pages of the funniest stuff that you've ever read about a literary figure who in his time, in Twain's time, was considered, you know, a giant, one of the foremost American writers. And he just skewers it. He just skewers the Leather Stocking series and makes a lot of fun out of it. But it's because of the inaccuracy of observation. Another time he writes a preface to a book where he talks about the weather in this book. He decides that it's a waste of time to include details about the weather in the book, and that if you look in the back, you'll see an appendix which will describe the weather conditions for any given page that you're on, and which is, of course, completely fabricated. There was no appendix at the back. But he would just make fun of literary conventions and wasting time. He would get to the point. His first rule of writing was eschew surplusage. And even in that, there's this tremendous humor, because you can imagine somebody thinking, oh, yeah, eschew surplusage.
Well, and Harry, you write a lot about his well, I guess in many ways, I mean, he was a best-selling author. He was a superstar celebrity, but he was all of these things at a time when nobody else was those things, right? I mean, today,
normal. There were celebrities, and he encountered many of them. But there was no American who became as celebrated, as well-known. But again, we go back to travel and influence. His books often were printed first in England because the English loved him, and his books would get distributed to, you know, the outposts of English, the English Empire at the time, and were read widely in Australia and the Far East and elsewhere. And so he became this international celebrity, and he cultivated that. There was a rock star moment in Iowa City when he was just tired of the grind and put on a poor performance and got lambasted in the paper. It wasn't, you know, always a picnic for him, never mind the domestic issues with his family. It was just a rough grind sometime, but because of that grind, because of landmark tours nationally in the mid-1880s and then worldwide in the 1890s as he sought to regain his fortune, he reached, as far as any American writer ever has in their own time.
Joan is on the line in Iowa City with a favorite Twain quote. Hi, Joan.
Hi. I wanted to just give you a quick quote that's hanging in Mark Twain's school in Iowa City. And it's a quote. It says, "Travel is fatal to prejudice, bigotry, and narrow-mindedness, and many of our people need it sorely. Broad, wholesome, charitable views cannot be acquired by vegetating in one's little corner of the earth." 1869.
Joan, thank you so much for sharing that. And I think so much of what we've talked about today shows that Samuel Clemens, Mark Twain, was a man so far ahead of his time. And Harry, that's a theme. You show us this man in context, but in reading your book about Mark Twain, I also leave feeling like he would be a man very much at ease in our times.
Well, I don't know. He'd be getting himself into trouble, I'm sure. If he's
maybe
on
not at ease.
But cable network. So I'm not sure he'd be at ease. He'd be having a lot of fun, though. And it occurred to me, you know, this morning on your news, you're talking about the political races and the election. I mean, he wrote The Gilded Age with Charles Dudley Warner, which was really named the age of political corruption and speculation and election reform and finance reform. You know, he said, well, you know, he priced out the political position. So you pay $10,000 for an influential senator, $3,000 for a congressman, $10,000 for a female lobbyist. I mean, he lays out all these wonderful things about our growing democracy, but it's a cry for good government. And with Mark Twain, it's a cry for good government. It's a cry for public education, and it's to educate the people and give them the freedom to explore their own lives and careers.
Harry, thank you so much.
Thank you very much, Charity. I enjoyed it very much.
Harry Katz is the author of the new Mark Twain's America: A Celebration in Words and Images. Will Thompson, thank you.
Thank you.
Will Thompson is an Iowa actor who portrays Mark Twain. This is Talk of Iowa.